and fresh air. My first guest is photographer John Phillips. He spent 5 decades photographing the leaders and events which have shaped modern history. Most of his work has appeared in Life magazine. John Phillips was born in Algeria, grew up in France, and as a young man moved to London. In 1936, he became Life's first overseas staff photographer. He documented the Nazi invasion of Europe, the lives of European high society, and the Jews and Arabs in the Middle East before and during the establishment of Israel, and that's just to name some of the events that John Phillips has covered and photographed. John Phillips has gathered over 500 of his photographs and written the text for his photo memoir, It Happened in Our Lifetime, which is published by Little Brown. And thanks for coming here today and coming down
Pleasure.
From New York. In looking through your book and the 50 years of photographs which you've collected, it really struck me as it's this document not only of our times but also of your life. And I guess few people are fortunate to have this type of document that is both the world and their own memories.
It's
and what
a photobiography in a way, words and pictures.
Did you relive your experiences very
much? Oh, yes, because, you see, I did it chronologically. It seemed to me important to show how the world had changed. Things that were normal then suddenly. When I look back on some of the pictures, for instance, the Cecil Beaton party given in 1937 where everybody's dressed up, well, the lady dressed up as a shepherdess is closer to Marie Antoinette than she is to us. So as the book goes along, I wanted to give an idea to the readers how the world was changing and why it changed. So the first part is rather gentle. It's a dying world. It's lovely. It's comfortable. It's probably misery, but there's also a lot of luxury. And then suddenly the Nazis. And then the whole world changes. And we go back at the end of one part of a book to see England with a very rich and not so rich anymore and how it has changed in a whole. So to give a reader a feeling of how his world changed, and somewhere down the line, he stepped into that world because, of course, not everybody's 71 like me today, so they stepped in at one of the episodes of his history.
You really started photographing in the mid-30s, right?
In 36, can tell you exactly. I first heard of Life on November 2nd, 1936. I got a letter from Time magazine informing me they had bought a picture of mine, which incidentally they paid $14 for and they didn't use. And I realized I made much more money not being published in the States than being published in England. And they were starting a new magazine. I went there and they said it's going to be called Life. And, of course, this was tremendously dramatic to see for dummy. And I gave them my name and address. And they said, we'll call you if we need you. And the next day they called me and I did the first story. So my first story is really Edward VIII. It is the end of an era. So really he marks, I stepped in at the beginning of end of an epoch.
Well, you had mentioned to me that you hadn't really seen your photographs all collected until about 1968 because you were in Europe.
I was in Europe.
Yeah. What was the impression that you had of your work when you saw it all collected?
Well, a lot of pictures I'd forgotten. For instance, there's one that never had been used, I completely had forgotten it, was when Mr. Churchill took me to the Tehran conference in November 1943, the first great summit. And the three big Stalin, Roosevelt and Stalin are seated there posing, and suddenly Mike Riley, the head of the American Secret Service, leans over and whispers in Mr. Roosevelt's ear. And I always wondered, what could he say? It couldn't be important. Did he say, I found a lighter, Mr. President, or I think you forgot your cigarettes? It had to be something like that. So that was a picture I put in a book, as a matter of fact, but I'd never seen. So it was a discovery in some cases, some of my work. Pleasure, some cases. Sometimes you figure, I wish I'd done that, and it's a mixed feeling.
Did you see yourself as a photographer differently after you finally had a chance to see all your collected work?
Yes, because, you see, we never talked of art on Life. We took pictures. You see, our great job was communications. We went. Now, of course, composition is very important. I mean, you may look at a picture. I may not call it art, but you like it because it's beautifully composed, and you say it is a work of art, and it can be. But we didn't set out to do art. We set out to tell a story, and everything fits in. A good composition is like good writing in the text. So a photographer works like a writer. Somebody said, is a camera impartial? I said, well, just as impartial as a typewriter. It depends who's using it.
I think among what struck me is among some of the most dramatic events that you witnessed and photographed was the invasion of Vienna in 1938. Now, you had just arrived in Vienna just shortly before the Germans...
What had happened was that March 11th, 1938, I was taking pictures in St. James's in London, never aware that my career as a society photographer was over. They said, beat it to Vienna. There's going to be a vote whether Austria wants to join Germany in what it was then called the Anschluss. And I got there. I got on a train. We crossed the border at Innsbruck in Austria. Somebody came in and said, Hitler's taken over Austria. What he did is his army hadn't taken it over, but he forced the government to abdicate, and his young Nazis took over the country, which they held for 24 hours. So that is how I was in Vienna when Hitler occupied, and it's really Hitler's conquest number one.
And so you hadn't planned on beating him there or anything like that?
Nobody expected. You see, my generation grew up with World War One, where you lost 1 million men to take a salient of 300 yards. To see a country of 8.5 million disappear without a shot and without anybody really getting excited was shocking. It was a startling experience.
What are your recollections of just the first moments of the occupation?
Well, that night I was I got there in the evening, and I was on a balcony of a correspondent of the United Press, and I'd rented the best room I could, which had a beautiful big balcony, looked on the ring. And below me, I had all this mob. Now, until you've seen a Nazi mob in action, you haven't seen anything. It's probably, if you were to compare, you've seen Iranians showing off for television during a hostage. It's like that, but in European clothes, and that's deadly scream, Germany, Germany, Sieg Heil. And I looked, and I knew I had to go down and take pictures there in a very hostile environment, because one, Hitler did not like Time Incorporated, whom he thought was unfriended to the Nazis, I'm glad to say. And secondly, it was difficult because you were supposed to have a special pass to photograph. The minute Hitler, Nazis took over, said no pictures are taken without permits. So this correspondent said, well, you're lucky not to have any permit, but if you haven't got one, you're going to be in trouble. And as I described it, I felt like a lobster about to be dropped in boiling water, looking at that seething mob. And I had to go down there and get pictures. And so there is a way you had to work. I had to say, well, how am I going to do it? And I thought, well, let's use a German mind and play around that. Now, the Germans were, and at that point, exceedingly orderly, if you like, in a disorderly way. So I decided to rent a big Daimler car, one of the biggest ones in Vienna, put two big swastikas and a driver in black, and was so conspicuous when I drove down, everybody saw me. And the reaction was, well, he must have a permit. Nobody would just go around like that without a permit. And the trick was to take a picture and get away before somebody said, let's see his permit. And I did that for 4 days and got away with it.
And you had a young Jewish journalist with you, too.
I had hired him to tell me where the streets were and what was happening. I want him to keep a low profile as much for his sake as for mine. And you see, again, using a German mentality, the border where the Nazis were checking was one toward Czechoslovakia, which was pro-democratic. I sent all my films to London via Berlin because a German mind would never think, why send them? We could confiscate it. Why? And that's the way that my films got through. And I put my captions as letters, and not one of them got through.
Why were Hitler's people opposed to Time?
Well, we had done a March of Time, which was a division of Time Inc., had done a movie called Inside Nazi Germany. Time and Life had very definite views that Hitler was a peril. I mean, and we were not his favorite characters.
You also mentioned that soon after the occupation, you'd hear the broadcasts of Hitler's speeches in public. Were there loudspeakers set up?
Oh, yes. He was a genius at the public relations. He didn't have television, but he had radio. And he had loudspeakers put in all the main arteries of town and a radio. And everybody in the street listened to your Führer. So you better not be caught inside. So he'd pack a street. So he'd film them with searchlights, you know, to show the crowds. And the crowds literally would get absolutely frantic when they listened to his voice. He had that extraordinary hypnotic quality on the Germans. You and I might find him a bore or a charlatan, but they thought he was the greatest German in history.
When did you when did you figure it was time to leave Austria and move on?
Well, after, you see, each day you saw the German grip get stronger. You see, the minute the army came in, the Gestapo came in, first thing they did, they started putting Jew on all the Jewish stores. They started pilfering them. It was obvious they were arresting a great number of people, because those who say had never heard of a concentration camp till after the war is ridiculous. I'd heard it, and they were arresting people. And you could feel that German pressure in a dictatorship. You feel that feeling. And I realized I'd got a certain number of pictures. I wasn't going to get much more. You see, you get good pictures when everything is in disorder. The Germans, the Nazis, were then bringing a form of order. Nothing more was journalistic. I couldn't go and ask for interviews. So I decided to leave. We've had a few anti-Semitic activities, the Nazis. I wanted to get out. And so again, I decided, well, the best way to do is to take a train, cross a border at dawn, because the custom officials are usually a little sleepy. And luckily, I had a sleeper. We had two bunks, one above the other. And a man in a lower bunk who shared my cabin happened to be, I was lucky, a big shot in the Nazi party, because I saw it on a station platform. They were hiling him. And I knew they would search me, so I'd got rid of all my unexposed film. I only had 3 rolls of exposed film. And I had them in my pajama pocket in one little bag. And I suddenly thought, well, across from my bed was a hanger, and there was this coat. And I'll never forget, a big, heavy black coat, and a pocket was sort of open. And I said, why not put my films in his pocket? He'll never search him. He'll certainly search me, which I did. And the customs came. He searched me, found nothing. And then the thing was to get the films back. And that was a little more difficult, because he didn't go to sleep at first. Then finally turns the light out, and he's going to sleep. And I had my hand in his pocket when a cabin was suddenly all lit up. And I jumped back and banged my head, because I thought he had turned the light on, I'd be caught. What had happened is a customs, during the inspection, had opened the blinds. So we passed the station at that moment, and a light flashed in. So I got back, got my films, and got them out. But it was a rather nervous moment, I must say.
Well, you then went back to London, right?
I went back to London.
And but then went back into German-occupied territory.
Then they sent me back to Poland, which was not Czechoslovakia, which everybody expected to be the next on the list, and Poland. In that moment, it got difficult to take pictures of the German minorities, because after the disappearance of the Germans of Austria, everybody pretended they had no German minorities, because they knew Hitler would claim them. So that got to be a little difficult. And I remember when I got to Danzig in Poland, not in Danzig, in Poznan, in a Polish corridor, I asked the hotel dorm, and I said, where's this German big meeting, a Nazi meeting? He said, what meeting? I said, you know, Nazis a meeting, never heard of it. Well, I went around, and luckily I found some young German who said, oh, yes, there's a big rally, let me take you. He took me there in a circus, and there was the inevitable scene, the Nazis in white shirts, black pants and jack boots. And the Poles said, they wanted to play the German national anthem. The Poles said, if you played, we're going to really beat the hell out of you, which they would have. And so I got my pictures, got out, went back and telephoned my story. As I went out, this sullen doorman beamed and said, oh, I liked your story. If I had known what you wanted, I would have told you all about it. I said, how do you know? Oh, he said, I listened into your phone call, and I really approved of what you said.
Would you have to be careful about how you would make phone calls with the idea that people would be listening?
In those days, well, it depended. No, it wasn't so efficient. Today, if you're talking in a communist country, obviously, you book your call. And so you have to wait, and you know that. I remember in some cases I'd have to wait an hour because the man who was going to listen in was out for lunch or having a drink. No, in those days it was much more slap happy, I would say.
When you were in Poland, you also photographed the Warsaw Ghetto.
Right? I did a Warsaw Ghetto, yeah. And see, that was one of the pictures Life wanted. They wanted me to get the Jewish ghettos, the Germans, and the Russians. The Russian border. So I called up from Prague our local stringer. We always had stringers in all these countries. And I told him, he said, "Brava, you want a photograph of free things that the Poles don't want to have published. And you may have problems getting in." So I went to see the Polish consul, and I had a big crowd of people. And in an arrogant way, I had a British passport. I brushed past everybody. I said, "Let me see the consul," threw my passport on a table and said, "I'm one of these rare people who've got money, likes to travel. I want to see Warsaw." And with which I gave him a 1,000 krona bill, which I had managed to get by giving a lot of 100 bills. And of course, that was a sort of very rare currency. I mean, you'd have bills like that if you're buying a car or something. And I knew I'd create a complication, but it also created the illusion here was this rich boy. And it worked. They gave me a visa. See, I didn't have my profession listed on my passport.
What were the conditions like when you photographed the ghetto?
The ghetto was very, very poor. And see, at that point, the Polish government was not very democratic. That was Colonel Beck. And this is why the Poles were very worried that I should get pictures, because they had a saying that the screams of the Jews in the Warsaw ghettos were heard in Brooklyn. And, of course, aid was sort of dropping, you know, the American was sending less money. I mean, and so they didn't want to have it. And it was really a tragic story of a lot of people in a packed-in area. And, of course, pictures change. You see, now those I took in 1938, you'll see in a book, were interesting, but now we are deeply moving, because by what happened, the three little sisters sitting was a nice picture, but if you think that they were all killed, because certainly they had no chance of escape. Or the ghetto itself, which got demolished, I re-photographed it in 1945, and it was rubble.
Yeah, I know the difference is so striking, because the first photograph that you mentioned, it doesn't necessarily look like like a horrible place.
It looks like Fiddler in a Roof.
Right, I mean it's a real
It's a little
country.
Poor, mm-hmm. But it's human. I mean, people are living here, people are rather poor, but they're living among themselves. And they were very not happy, because in a ghetto they were all right. You see, so when they got out, they might have a pogrom or get hit over the head.
Was there a sense of an inevitable the inevitable disaster for the people that were living
at that point? No, I don't think. You know, first of all, nobody thought of a final solution at that point. We knew there were camps. And then, you see, we were innocent. It was a very innocent epoch. Who imagined that Germany would take all of Poland in 1 month? I mean, it was we've forgotten how powerful this German machine was now that it was smashed. And so they suddenly came. The Poles thought they would win. As a matter of fact, I have a picture there of people on a bicycle and a little biplanes. That's what Poland went to war with, completely convinced they would take care of the Germans, or at least hold their own. And they did very well, but they lasted a month. Great country like France collapsed in 2 weeks. I mean, so nobody quite expected. Then, when it was too late, everybody, of course, realized the monstrosity of that machine.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is John Phillips, and he's spent nearly 50 years photographing different parts of the world. Most of his work has appeared in Life, and he's collected his photographs and also written a text in a kind of photo memoir called It Happened in Our Lifetime, and that's published by Little Brown. When you would be in, like, behind enemy lines, so to speak, would you have to learn tricks of smuggling?
No, you couldn't there, because what you did was you had to submit the pictures to the War Department. See, I was responsible to the U.S. I was a U.S. war correspondent, so I'd ship my material out. I'd give it to the public affairs officer in Italy, or wherever my theater was, with my captions. He would send them to Washington. Then Washington, under great secrecy, I mean, would send them to Life, would develop them, would show them, obviously, to nobody. The censor would censor whatever they had to and release the pictures. See, censorship was very interesting, because it really referred very often to a little something or other which turned out to be a radar, but to the average reader would mean nothing. I mean, that was a thing. Or we had airbrush, say, you have to take this weapon out or do that. Smuggling. No, your job was to sometimes convince the censors that they could release a picture. And sometimes in the Middle East there you had political censorship. For instance, I remember photographing the first Yugoslav partisan mission in Cairo, and I got in the hospital and photographed me with wounded men. So the English censor saw me, said, "You do get around, Phillips," and said, I stop his pictures. And he held them up. So you'd have to try and argue, but why? So political censorship was difficult.
When you'd get to a new area, how would you orient yourself? How would you try to make contacts?
Well, if it was wartime or peacetime, you mean?
Well, let's start with wartime.
Well, in wartime, of course, you'd be accredited, so you would go. You would go to the public affairs or public relation officer, tell them who you were, and then you would have bulletins, you would have briefings, and you'd cover the story. If it was the Italian front, there was only one story, really. It was with the army moving up. Or you could do other stories, we discovered, for instance, in Naples that the writer Saint-Exupéry was there, so you do a story on the poet, Aviator. That was way. If you worked, as I worked in Europe, you worked like a reporter. That is to say, whereas a reporter would sit and do his interviewing, the photographer would do the same thing. And the moment the reporter would sit down to write his story, I'd go and photograph it. You'd have to know what you were photographing. You had to really do your homework and not just shoot idly. I mean, a country represented certain things, was in the news for a certain reason. So you had to focus on the highlights which made that country interesting, or the personalities in it, or the conflict, or whatever made it a story.
How about just for your own, just when you set up base, your own living base? I mean, what would you want to find out as far? I mean, would you need to find out what the restaurants were or the best bars or who you could trust? Or
you'd find out. You see, a photographer, I learned, would have to learn to make instant friendship. You'd have to see somebody and say, "I trust him," especially in hostile countries, because you might ask somebody, and if you reported to the government, you could be expelled. So the question was, you'd have to learn who to trust, how to trust. And then there you'd get around. So with other correspondents, they would tell you, well, what the ropes, this is where you stay, this is where you eat, these are the contacts, this fellow in the government's pretty friendly to the press. And so you'd learn the tricks pretty fast.
How would you be able to tell whether or not to trust one of the local people?
It's instinct. I mean, you'd meet somebody and you'd talk. See, I learned one thing. Let's say we meet, and if both of us share the same interests and we agree, that to me does not necessarily mean we are friends. We can get on. But if we both hate the same things and the same person, that is a quick way. So I'd always try and find out where we could both agree on disliking something, and there you can tell much more of a person's character than agreeing with him.
Do you think you were ever... I guess set up is not the right word, but if there was ever a government agent that might have approached you to see whether or not you were maybe an American spy or anything like that.
No, in those days, you see, the whole thing changed with the CIA. In my time, for instance, when I went to Warsaw, I would check in with the ambassador, would invite you for lunch. And you would sit and you would exchange views. There was no intelligence report. Generally, you brought him more information than he gave you. But if he was a very good ambassador, you'd get to find out things. Now, I learned a great trick was to always go and see an ambassador in a country who had no direct interest in a cause, you see, an independent. You'd sit and talk to him, and you'd swap views. And yes, I saw, well, I interviewed so-and-so. Yes, he said that. So this does not rank with espionage. After that, of course, since the CIA, some correspondents were infiltrated, and that was an entirely different proposition. But what we did was perfectly above board. Like, I'd go to Washington before going to Latin America. Once I'd have a briefings at a State Department where they would. So this was perfectly correct.
Did that make your work as a photographer more difficult once foreign governments were suspicious of the CIA?
I would guess. You see, the thing is, a great trick, if you were in a foreign country, was to try and guess who was a CIA man and not go near him. That was a great trick. See, a lot of things a journalist doesn't need to know. For instance, what is important in spying is not important in journalism. For instance, the last thing in the world would have ever to go to Oak Ridge and know anything about atomic energy or anything about figures on Air Force, which don't affect the story. Because what you don't know, you can't tell. And I didn't want to risk suddenly being, well, you can't go abroad because you've seen too much. So, a lot of actually spying is now, of course, very common talk because there's so much going on. But it's industrial intelligence. So a lot of the material you can find in publications, I mean technical papers and all of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is photographer John Phillips, and a collection of his photographs, most of which have appeared in Life magazine over the last 50 years. He's collected those photographs in a photo memoir called It Happened in Our Lifetime. One of the most powerful photographs, I thought, in the book was of an execution of a war criminal in Czechoslovakia, and it's a close-up, and you see the noose around his neck. There's about to be a hanging. And it's a public execution. I believe you wrote that 55,000 people.
Yes, it was extraordinary. Standing there, they wanted to see him hanged. You see, he had been, which made his crime all the worse, he had been a professor at a German university in Prague. And he had decided that Prague was not a Czech city, a German one, and was going to eradicate any Czech influence. And he executed students, which is not done if you're an academic. Not done by anybody, but less of all by an academic. So the crowd came to just see him. And the Czechs are rather unique. 50,000 stood there. You could get past at a sort of corridor. They didn't protest. The only thing is when he saw him appear on a gallows, there was a, ooh, and that was all. And once he was hanged, they peacefully walked away. Just wanted to see him hanged.
How did you prepare yourself emotionally for that?
I had already seen one execution before that. And the way it happened was I was in the Middle East. It was August. And I said to our American attaché, anything cooking? Oh, he said, we have an execution 29th of September. But I said, we're August. And I thought you shot spies at dawn the day after the trial. He said, that's right. We try them at 28th, or they will try them at 28th, and they shoot them at 29th. So I went to Aleppo to see it. Now, all that day, I was driving from Cairo to Aleppo. I thought, my God, I am seeing an execution. Now, is this going to affect me the rest of my life? I mean, seeing somebody killed. You know, if you press the button and somebody dies in the other room, you do it. Maybe if you was a villain. But seeing, participating, you know, you thought, how is it going to affect me? And I was there feeling awful. And luckily, when these two spies were brought out, they started to insult us. They were pro-Nazi. They said, death to you. And I was so happy because I got in a rage. And when you are mad, and it helped me, and I noticed, and all my friends who photographed the execution, well, all, one of them, Karl Maidens, the same thing as myself. At the end, our pictures are blurry because we are so excited that you can't hold a camera. And I'd put it on a tripod, but still you were cranking up and down. And after it's over, you know, it's a very strange thing. There he is, and I got pictures of people staring at the body in a sort of banal way. They put them in a coffin which had sawdust so they wouldn't bleed through it, nail it up and drive off. And the rest of the day would be a very long day. You had to think, you know, a man being killed, even if he's an enemy, there's something about mortality which affects human beings, I think at least civilized. So at the end of all these years, I had nightmares. This is probably the price of doing my kind of life. My friend Kappa used to scream in his sleep, apparently. I had nightmares, and he always had a recurring nightmare. You were captured, you were about to be executed. You were sitting there waiting to die, and it was awful because it was so real. And then luckily, I don't know if I'd probably sort of gone on dreaming I was executed. I might have died. I don't know, but I always, thank God, woke up in time. But it was awful. You'd wake up and the rest of the day, you had this hanging over you because it was you had a feeling. I pretty much have a good idea of what a man must feel before he's shot, having dreamt that.
It kind of sounds like, in a sense, an occupational hazard of your work.
It is, especially if you do violence. You see, you have to see it. Now, I learned one thing. A photographer can be callous when he takes pictures. And I learned that when I photographed the human soap factory. Pictures which, incidentally, have never been published because even today where everything is published, those still can't be. And when I was told after the war that there was a human soap factory in Poland, I said, oh, come on, I know the Nazis were awful, but still, you don't turn people into lava. No, they said. And I got there, and they said, yes, there's a soap factory. Now, I was afraid I'd be callous. I didn't know how I'd react, because when you take pictures, you take pictures. So we were passing, it was a Boston ship unloading wheat, and a Bostonian, a captain, I said, hey, would you like to come and see a human soap factory? So he joined me. Couldn't believe it. And we walked in, it was in a little room, and there were big vats and a terrible smell of formaldehyde, and they pulled up a lid, and we all looked in. It was stacked with bodies which were hacked and bled, and there was a dead monkey in it. My Boston captain went out and was violently sick, and I never saw him again. These are the only pictures in my life. I set up a camera, looked away. The fellow looked away while he opened the lid of a vat, called out. I took my picture. We closed it, and I only saw him after. And I couldn't. So I realized there's a limit to what to human callousness when you take pictures. That was it for me.
Well, it's been real interesting speaking with you. Thanks for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
On Fresh Air. My guest has been John Phillips, and his collection of photographs covering about nearly 50 years, over 500 photographs that have appeared in Life magazine, is collected in his book, It Happened in Our Lifetime, and that's published by Little Brown. And now you're based now in Long Island?
I live in Long Island, yeah. Yes.
Well, thanks again.
And I'm not in Europe. Thank you.
It's 25 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My name is Danny Miller. I'm sitting in this week for Terry Gross. Terry's on vacation, and she'll be back on Monday. At 4 o'clock, we'll be airing two different programs on South Africa. At 4, an interview that 91FM's news director, John Barth, did with Peter Kostmeier, who has just returned from South Africa, where he met with both black and white leaders in South Africa. And then at about 4:15, we'll hear a speech that South African Anglican Bishop Desmond Tutu gave on Tuesday at the University of Pennsylvania. So that's all coming up later today on Fresh Air. Right now, it's time for The Record Ranch with Bob Carlin.
Look out, friends. Here's Leon. Take it away, boys. Take it away. Oh, everybody dance now.
Good afternoon, I'm Bob Carlin, and this is The Record Ranch, and today we're going to be listening to some new wave old-time music. Let's face it, urban folk audiences are as fickle as their larger pop counterparts. And this is no criticism, I'm sure that you would all agree with me if you listen to folk music. Fads are just as common in folk music as anywhere else. In the 1960s, it was hip to like the blues. In the late 1970s, Celtic music was big, and singer-songwriters are making a strong comeback in the 1980s. Throughout all of this, Appalachian fiddle and banjo music, like the salmon, fights its way upstream, surfacing now and again in the folk clubs and festivals, generally known to an underground network of musicians scattered throughout the United States. Because old-time music, as it is called by the musicians that play it, or old-timey by those who don't, is construed to be uncommercial, even within the small folk marketplace, few record labels will chance putting the bands on LPs. Happily, that situation has been recently remedied by a stream, although not a flood, of new releases. We'll discuss two new LPs today, Young Fogies on Heritage, and Chokers and Flies on the Rounder record label. Young Fogies is a double record survey of the current state of urban old-time music. Produced by Ray Alden, it is a sequel to his Visits LP of several years back. Young Fogies succeeds as a sampler of current urban old-time bands and is recommended to those seeking a collection that features both cuts already heard on limited release LPs and cassettes, as well as music recorded by Alden. We're going to hear two cuts from the Young Fogies collection. First off, in the vein of a very traditional treatment of a old-time tune, the Old Hollow String Band. They hail from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and we're going to hear them play the tune Twinkle Little Star.